All right, welcome to 2,000 Years of Jewish Odyssey. How come no one sits over here, except for Gary? This is the 4th century of the Common Era, and was sponsored, as always, by Becky Navikatz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Reb Aryeh Leib. As the 4th century dawned, there were roughly 3 million Jews in the world. That means that centuries of persecution and dispersion had already taken their toll. If you recall from the first lecture, in the beginning, the first half of the first century of the Common Era, the Romans counted almost 8 million Jews. So that means in 300 years, we lost 5/8 of our people, from 8 million to 3 million. Those dramatic reductions were not uncommon in Jewish history, unfortunately, if you look at it a couple of centuries at a time. Now, Jews were scattered across the Roman Empire, and in Babel, of course. In the empire, except for Gaul, which is today France, where Jews lived in the heartland, Jews mostly lived elsewhere on coastal land, where access to ports were better for trade and commerce, and of course Jews were businessmen. So Jews lived everywhere, from the southern part of Spain, near Cordoba, to in Genoa, in Rome, on both coasts of southern Italy, in Carthage and Alexandria, a large community in western Turkey, especially around Ephesus, which is on the western coast of Turkey. Jews lived along the Rhine also, where we were noted as active slave traders, and in Cyprus and Asia Minor, as far north as the Caucasus. And Jews, of course, were heavily represented in Bavel, with communities along both rivers at this time, both the Tigris and the Euphrates. Sura itself, where the great yeshiva was, is on the Euphrates, and Pumpedisa was located at the southern confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates. And of course, Jews lived at the beginning of the 4th century in Eretz Yisrael as well. Rav Yochanan, who was the head of the yeshiva in Tveria, died in 288. He was succeeded by that famous pair, Rav Ami and Rav Asi, both of whom had come from Bavel, linked in the Gemara in numerous machlokos, as well as linked in death. They're buried next to each other, and just a few yards away from Rav Yochanan's grave in the ancient cemetery in Tveria, where you could see it still today. That's where the Rambam was later buried as well. Now, one of the giants of this age was Rav Zeira. Rav Zeira came from Bavel also to live and to learn in Israel. So the Gemara says in Bava Metzia, Daf Pei Hei Amud Aleph, that Rav Zeira fasted 100 times when he came from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, D'lishtakach Gemara Bavlo Minei. He should be able to forget the Babylonian style of learning, Hihechi D'lo Mitradei. So it should not upset, it should not ruin his grasp of the way they learned in Eretz Yisrael. He wanted to absorb a new derech in learning. What was the difference? Rashi says he came from Bavel to learn with Rabbi Yochanan, v'amoron sheb Eretz Yisrael lohoyu b'nei machlokes. The amorim in Israel were not argumentative with each other. They had a different approach. When they learned, they each listened to the other's opinion and tried together to find the truth. V'nochen zelo zekeshemen. And they were pleasant with one another, smooth like oil. U'miyashrin esatayim below kushos uperukin. And they resolved their issues without innumerable questions and comments and objections. In Bavel, it was the exact opposite. They're very argumentative. No one would give a quarter. No one would want to give in on his opinion. And Reb Zeira found the new derech, and that was in Eretz Yisrael. So the yeshiva in Tveria was the spiritual center, although it was closed for a time after a pogrom in 305. Now, around that same time, Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya II, who was a great-grandson of Rebbe, died in Sipori. His successors lacked his erudition, and he's already 305. He became the last of the Nasiyim to be mentioned in the Talmud Bavli, which wouldn't be published for another 150 or so years, a little longer than that. But none of the other Nisim in Eretz Yisrael merited mention in the Talmud Bavli, although a handful were mentioned still in the Talmud Yerushalmi. Meanwhile, at the same time, Rabbi Abohu had opened the yeshiva in Caesarea, right in the lion's den. That was the seat of the Roman government in Israel. Rabbi Abohu was a very charismatic figure who retained good relations with Rome, part of the reason why he was there. The Gemara says in Bamatziah Daf Pei Dalet Amud Aleph, Shufrei de Rabbi Abohu ke'en Shufrei de Yaakov Avinu. The visage, the appearance of Rabbi Abohu was akin to that of Yaakov Avinu. So of course we don't know what Yaakov looked like, so I assume it means that he bore a striking physical personality, but also on a personal level. His life was similar to Yaakov's. Yaakov too had to spend a good part of his life in the lion's den with Laban and with Esau, and yet he thrived in both places. So did Rabbi Abohu, but even his yeshiva closed in Caesarea with his death in 310. So if you think about it, within a span of just 5 years, at the beginning of the 4th century, the land of Israel lost the last yeshiva to host the Sanhedrin, that would be in Tveria, the last Nasi, who was embraced as a Talmud Chacham by all Jews, and the last Gadol, Rav Ami, acknowledged by all, even in Bavel, as the leading Talmud Chacham of the generation. All this was caused by the turmoil that would seize a Roman Empire in decline in the 4th century in a way that would shape our lives until today. How so? Well, the Roman Emperor from 284 to 305 was Diocletian. Diocletian brought a measure of stability to Roman life after the turbulence of the 3rd century. You remember from last week, Diocletian was not openly or actively hostile to Jews, which for us, we say Zocho Latov. That itself is worthy of praise. There was one notable event during his reign, and that was the final exclusion of the Samaritans from the Jewish people. So the people that the Gemara refers to as Kutim, from Kuta, brought by Ashur before the first Churban. So Navi says that they became converts. They were Gerei Arroyos with an olive. They became converts when they were attacked by lions. The Malachim Bey is the story. Attacked by lions, and they felt, they deduced they were being attacked by lions because they had not embraced the host religion. So Gemara has a discussion, machlokas, whether they were Gerei Emes or Gerei Arroyos, true converts or converts just out of fear. So for almost seven centuries, their status was in doubt. They observed some mitzvahs, not others. Regarding trumas and maestros, we always find discussions what you could eat from them, what you can't eat from them. By this time, around the year 300, they'd openly become pagans. They allied themselves with Rome or with the Christians in Israel, and Chazal banished them from the Jewish people. You see, some people have their status unresolved for centuries. I mean, we're in a similar situation today, Rahman al-Islam, with Reformed Jews, for example. There are 500,000 or so Reformed Jews in America, 500,000 who are not Jews kahalacha. So what is their status? What will become of them? Same thing with hundreds of thousands of Russian Jews in Israel. So we want these issues resolved yesterday, not even tomorrow. But you see, Chazal gave it 6 or 7 centuries, which is, I guess, a luxury that an eternal people has. Diocletian was a very interesting personality. He was known as a reformer. Now, that word has, unfortunately, become a pejorative in recent American political life. But Diocletian was a reformer. He was the first emperor to distribute power. Diocletian essentially divided the Roman Empire into 4 geographic regions with separate governments in each of the 4 regions, all for the purpose of making government more efficient. Even more interesting and unheard of in the time, he abdicated power in 305. He was aging, and he wanted to ensure a smooth transition, so he abdicated. The smooth transition was not to be, and it sets off one of the turning points in the history of the world. So Diocletian left office by instituting a systematic persecution of Christianity. at the time, under his reign, Judaism was tolerated because we were an ancient religion. We had a history with Rome already. Christianity was not. It was a religion that was relatively new, and also because of their numbers, they were now threatening to the empire. In the 3rd century of the Common Era, you already had some Christian thinkers that had begun to flesh out the doctrines of Christianity, which were not at all clear, even at this point, and which had already generated great disputes. So by the beginning of the 4th century of the Common Era, Christians numbered about 5 to 7 million people, twice as many Jews already in the world, and they were becoming a political force. In any event, Diocletian's plans for a smooth succession did not materialize. He divided the empire amongst his generals, who naturally fought with each other. And Rome plunged into a brutal civil war that lasted more than a decade and a half. One casualty of the war at the beginning was the yeshiva in Tveria. Another was the war between his generals and the local rulers that he had appointed. So finally, in the middle of the 2nd decade, one general died, and he was succeeded by his son, Constantine, who moved ruthlessly to consolidate power. Now comes one of the most famous stories in Christianity. In 312, as Constantine was marching to Rome to battle Maxentius, who at the time had been the leading general, he camped before the Milvian Bridge on the banks of the Tiber River, and there, according to a famous Christian legend, he had a vision of the night, of a cross in the sky with a legend underneath, in hoc signo vinces, in this sign conquer. Well, a vision is a vision. What is true is that almost overnight, Constantine renounced paganism and became a Catholic. He conquered Rome the next day. He attributed his conquest to his new religion. Maxentius he threw in the Tiber River, and the rest is history, literally, because Constantine did consolidate his power, and in an attempt to unify the kingdom, in 323 he declared Christianity to be the official religion of the Roman Empire. So overnight, it all changed. So began what we call the Malchus Edom, the Chazal called the Kingdom of Esav, which although it's weakened somewhat in the last 100 years, has been probably the dominant world power since, until about a century ago. Now, a number of events and personalities played a crucial role and affect us directly. One person was Eusebius, who was the bishop of Caesarea until 339. Eusebius became the first church historian, became the religious patron, and in fact biographer of Constantine. He was the one who brought the story of the vision of the cross. He was also a biblical archaeologist. Ironically, it's because of him, Eusebius, that we place Kever Rochel where it is today, south of Yerushalayim, in Beit Lechem, instead of north of Yerushalayim, which would seem to be indicated by the Torah and by Sukkim and Tanakh, those who came to Rav Borer, the Shabbos, he discussed this very issue. But Eusebius was the one who said, this is where it is, and Jews accepted it. So he told the story of Constantine and the cross, and something major happened in Christianity. Those interested, I refer you to the book Constantine's Sword by James Carroll. James Carroll was a former priest. I'm just a Levi, so I'll rely on him for what he knows about this. He says what Constantine brought to the world, to the Christian world, was a transformation of Christianity. Christianity became, first of all, a religion of the cross, meaning the crucifixion then became more important even than the resurrection. It became a religion that celebrated Jesus' death more than his life, with all the attendant problems that would cause for Jews, who were to be blamed for his death. With Constantine, all the questions that we've heard now for 16, 17 centuries immediately started. He asked the questions, along with the other leaders of the time. How can Christians convince pagans of the truth of Christianity when these contentions are rejected by Jews? How can Christianity base its validity on being the fulfillment of Jewish prophecy when the descendants of those prophets, Jews, repudiate Christianity. Jews obviously posed an internal threat to Christianity. He realized immediately, and so in 315, Constantine criminalized Jewish proselytizing and conversion. A century later, it became a capital crime for Jews to seek converts, but it became a crime in any event for a Christian to convert to Judaism in one form or another in different societies that exist until today. In 325, Constantine convened the Council of Nicaea, and that was the final and total break with Judaism. Nicaea is a town, a city in Asia Minor on the west coast of Turkey. And this council declared what became famous as the Nicene Creed, characterizing Jesus as a god, settling, at least for a time, the disagreements that had riven Christianity. For example, at the Council of Nicaea, they promulgated the doctrine of the Trinity. At Nicaea, they rejected Arianism. Arianism was a belief in Christianity with Jesus as the Messiah, but not as a God, not as divine. That was repudiated, and Arius himself was alive, was a bishop who had these ideas. He was excommunicated, and finally he was condemned as a heretic. They established at Nicaea the cross as the religious symbol of Christianity, which had not been before. They decided at Nicaea, very interestingly, we're entering that season now, on the dates for their December celebration, on the dates for Easter, severing any connection to the Jewish calendar that they had used for centuries to determine the Christian holidays. So how's this for irony? Until the Council of Nicaea, the Christians had to wait for the Sanhedrin to decide when Rosh Chodesh Nisan was, and then they could be koveh the day for Easter. Strange to think about it, it was abhorrent to Constantine, who said, and I quote, this Eusebius cited, "It is unbecoming that on the holiest of festivals we should follow the customs of the Jews. Henceforth, let us have nothing in common with this odious people." So they decided then to make the Feast of Saturnalia, which is a Roman pagan feast in late December, the major holiday. Easter was decided then and forever to fall on the first Sunday after the first full moon after the vernal equinox. That was the date. Now, ironically, Carroll notes very, very interestingly that something else changed here. Civilization changed. Because until this point, only Jews were educated. Pagans were not educated. The necessity to make their own calendar and rely on their own calendar meant that Christians now had to start studying math and science and not rely on Jews. And that itself, again, ironically, moved civilization forward. It's another personality of interest to us, and that was Constantine's mother, Helena. In 326, she embarked on a search for the true cross. So she found it in Yerushalayim, of course, after destroying a temple to Venus, which was on that spot. She was on a roll, must have been lucky. She found also the nails used in the crucifixion, and in the same time found this, what the Catholics call the seamless robe, the holy tunic that Jesus wore during his execution. That robe still exists. It's in the cathedral in Trier in Germany. And the wooden cross that she recovered was carved up into small pieces and distributed across the world, engendering the expression, knock on wood for good luck, which has been the English language since then. On this site in Yerushalayim, she was instrumental in building, right then in the 4th century, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which has been rebuilt a number of times, but still stands today. Within several generations, the church would be divided and subdivided. Today, of course, every inch is accounted for, and melees constantly break out over inches. As recently as 2 weeks ago, there was a riot inside the church that the police of Yerushalayim had to break up, fighting over a chair that had been put in someone else's location, etc. The warring Christian sects that fight in that church. Ambrose, the Jew-hating bishop of Milan, at the end of the 4th century, would record, he told a story of Helena, that, I quote again, clever Jews knew where the cross was hidden, and they knew its power, and so they had to torture one Jew to force him to reveal where the cross was buried. All this, of course, has no source, no trace in Jewish sources, and there's no substance to it. The only substance was in the centuries of persecution of Jews that Constantine's rule unleashed. Constantine himself was a megalomaniac. They're usually the ones who have the visions at night that no one else sees. So he built a city, Constantinople, in Turkey, named it after himself, on the Bosphorus. It was called Byzantium then. Now it's called Istanbul. The Muslims renamed it an Islamic name. He transformed every pagan temple in Rome to churches. He built basilicas, including St. Peter's Basilica, over the tomb of Peter in Rome. He built the Arch of Constantine, which is around the corner, about a block and a half away from the Arch of Titus. In Rome, he had three sons, get this, three sons named Constantine, Constantius, and Constance. These, if I name my three sons, Stephen, Steve, and Steve. Importantly, in 330, he shifted the capital of the empire from Rome to Constantinople. Rome, the citizens of Rome, having been reared on paganism, were not as quick to embrace Christianity as he had hoped. He went to Constantinople, and he too soon divided the empire into two provinces, east and west. So he ruled over both, but the split came after his death in 337. Christianity itself would then divide into two almost immediately. We'll see the same thing happen in Islam between Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodox Christianity, the latter based in Constantinople. Now, Israel, before Constantine's reign, was relatively unstable. But during his wars, there was a brief respite in the second decade of the 4th century, and the situation improved dramatically. So in that second decade, the yeshiva in Tveria reopened, this time under the leadership of Rav Yirmiya, also came from Bavel, whom the Gemara speaks very highly. The Gemara says, whenever you see the phrase, Amrei b'Ma'arava, it was said in the West, in Eretz Yisrael, that's a reference to Rav Yirmiya. This was the fourth generation of Amoraim in the land of Israel, and it was a relatively brief generation, less than 15 years. Meanwhile, Bavel had become the center of Jewish life in the 3rd century and now was dominant. Rav Chisda was the Rosh Yeshiva in Sura until his death in 309. Rav Chisda had married the granddaughter of Rav at the age of 16. When he was 16, he was a disciple, one of the younger Talmidim of Rav. He and Rav Huna were known in the Gemara as Sabe de Sura, the elders of Sura. After his death, Sura was temporarily eclipsed by Pumbedisa because of the presence of the giants Rabba and Rav Yosef. So the Gemara says in Brachos of Samach Dala Malalef and elsewhere, the difference between Rabba and Rav Yosef, the Gemara calls Rabba Oker Harim, the uprooter of mountains. He had a powerful conceptual mind, he was a genius of analysis, whereas Rav Yosef was Sinai. He had an exceptional memory. So he had a bank in which he was able to say what the Mishnayos, what the Brisos, what the Toseftos were. So Gemara says, which is more important, to be a Sinai or to be an Oker Harim? So it's more colorful to be an Oker Harim. But the Gemara says that Sinai is more important because everyone needs the Moreh Chitayo. Everyone needs the owner of the wheat. The wheat are the words of Chazal. If you don't have the wheat, there's nothing to analyze. So first you need the wheat. So in that sense, Rav Yosef was greater. Nonetheless, he refused at first to be the Rosh Yeshiva for a variety of reasons. Rabba was the Rosh Yeshiva for 22 years in Pumbedisa. When he died, Rav Yosef took over for a short time. He's already elderly, of 2.5 years. This really was a golden era in Bavel, especially compared to what was happening in Eretz Yisrael. The king was Shapur II. Remember, Shapur I, the friend of Shmuel, so he wasn't the son, may have been a grandson or a great-grandson. So he was coronated as king before his birth, which is a good job if you can get it. And he reigned for 69 years, entire life, until the year 379. So his reign of Shapur II took up most of the time in Bavel, like his most of the time of that century. Like his ancestor, he was very close to the Jews. The Jews also became very close to the Sasanian dynasty, especially in fear of what was happening now in the Christian world. Mainly, though, for most of the century, Jews were prosperous and serene in Bavel, especially because the Jews of Bavel were cherished because of the taxes that we paid, much like the Jews of Tinek are cherished today. Only problem, really, arose in the year 320, when Rabbah was accused of preventing Jews from working 2 months out of the year. This was reported to Shapur II, who at the time was all of 10 years of age. Why was Rabbah doing this horrific deed? Because the Yarchet Kahlo. Jews were coming to learn in Pumbedisa, we mentioned last time, in El and Adar. So they reported to the youthful king that that they're diminishing their potential income and thereby his tax revenue by not working these 2 months. Eventually, Rabbah had to flee Pumbedisa. He died very shortly thereafter at age 60. Rav Chisda died, he was 92, and that was when Rav Yosef succeeded him. Rav Yosef, the Gemara says, was blind, very humble person, very forgiving person. Within a few years, even Shapur II had realized the error of his accusation against Rabbah, and Shapur's mother, the royal mother, gave Rav Yosef, the Gemara records, a purse of gold coins to distribute to tzedakah. When he died in 323, a new era dawned, and that was the fourth generation of Amoraim in Bavel, and here we have some of the greatest and most mentioned figures in the Talmud, Abaye and Rava. Abaye became the Rosh Yeshiva in 326 in Pumbedisa after very interesting competition in learning. The Gemara records in Horios of Yudalim and Aleph, we don't have such competitions anymore. Each had to give up shots in a certain thing. The contestants were Abaye and Rava. Rabbi Zeir would come back from Eretz Yisrael, and Rabbah Bar Masna. And Abaye was selected as giving, I guess, the best Dvar Torah. Abaye was born an orphan. His father died when his mother was pregnant. Mother died in childbirth. He was raised by his uncle, the great Rabbah Bar Nachmoni. Abaye is short for father. His given name was Nachmoni after his grandfather. So Abaye is like Av or Abba. He had a foster mother of whom he speaks very often the Gemara, very highly, Umrali Aim. I heard from my mother, but he meant his foster mother. His famous Bar Plukta was Rava, who was slightly younger than Abaye. Rava had his own yeshiva in Mechoza, but Rava was also a student of Rabba, and together, hundreds of their disputes of Abaye and Rava are recorded, and the intensive study of Talmud is even defined as understanding Havoyos to Abaye v'Rava. If you understand their discussions and similar ones, then you know how to learn. Rava is one of the most prolific of the Amoraim, mentioned almost 2,000 times in the Talmud. Like I said last week, it's almost impossible to go a daf or two or three without encountering Abaye or Rava. Today's daf, I just happened to do it a little while ago, so Rava's mentioned two or three times in today's daf alone. By the time of Abaye and Rava, almost all the Gedolei Torah were concentrated in Bavel, and when Abaye died, Rava was naturally chosen to succeed him. Rava died in 352, and he in turn was succeeded in Pumbedisa by Rav Nachman, and then as the leading sage by Rav Papa, who started a yeshiva in Neresh when Rava, his Rebbe, died. Now Rav Papa is representative of the fifth generation of Amoraim in Bavel, and by our standards today, he certainly stands with Rosh Yeshiva, he's a very colorful figure. By profession, he was a brewer of beer. That's one way to get a lot of Talmidim to yeshiva, apparently. We forget that the greatest Rosh Yeshiva worked for a living. They weren't, yeshiva was basically in the early morning and the afternoons and the evening. But Rosh Yeshiva learned. Even though he headed the yeshiva, he also raised all 10 sons his 10 sons to be Talmidei Chachamim, imbued with the love of Torah? How would he encourage them? Exactly. He was so passionate that when they would complete a Masechta, Rav Papa would make a festive Siyum. And from that time henceforth, every Hadron that we make at a Siyum makes reference at the very beginning, without any elaboration, to all 10 sons of Rav Papa, Rav from Bar Papa, Nachman Bar Papa, etc., etc., without saying anything about them. Just as a note that the institution of the festive Siyum, that dates from Shlomo HaMelech, but in our lexicon, in our liturgy, rather, it was Rav Papa who made it a celebration. So he died in 371, but during his years, Jewish life changed irrevocably, all because of the decline in Eretz Yisrael. Meaningful Jewish settlement would end in Israel in the 4th century. I say meaningful because it's important to mention that Jews always lived in Eretz Yisrael. From the beginning of settlement in Yoshua ben Nun's time until today, there's never a time when Jews did not live in Eretz Yisrael. We'll get back to that in a little while. Now, the decline was largely due to the beginning of the Christian persecution of Jews. It was fueled already in Constantine's time by Jewish refusal to embrace Christianity and by the theological problems that were raised. But the land of Israel's influence waned in the middle of the century due to declining population and political pressures, as well as massacres, untimely massacres that occurred right in the middle of the century. Carroll writes that when we speak of the age of Constantine, the age of Constantine meant the end of the political aspirations of the Jews. So in that sense, the age of Constantine lasted from roughly 323 until 1948. But at this point, the end of meaningful settlement in the land of Israel did not come to its conclusion before there were some enduring and vital legacies. First of which was the Talmud Yerushalmi that was completed in 350. This, the product of an effort that had begun with Rav Yochanan 80 years earlier, was shorter than what became the Talmud Bavli. It was written in a very terse Aramaic, a more difficult, a different Aramaic than the Aramaic in Bavel. Was only written on 4 Sdorim, on Zroim Moed, Noshim, and Nezikin. Now the Rambam writes that there is Yerushalmi on Kotshim as well, and the only Seder without Yerushalmi is Taharos. That Yerushalmi on Kotshim, it's not extant. We don't know when it disappeared, or even if it even existed. There was a famous episode in the 19th century where some gadol in Europe, a little off, produced the Talmud Yerushalmi on Kodoshim, which he forged from beginning to end. And it took a few years to expose it as a forgery. Why would someone do such a thing? You sell it in Judaic House. No. Why would someone sit? Think about it. It had to be years to write in that difficult Aramaic, and to take the Mishnah and write a commentary on it. So sometimes great geniuses are a little off. The Talmud Bavli was more authoritative, and it generally is followed in case of dispute, but there are significant occasions when, for example, the Rambam will postulate like Yerushalmi over the Bavli. There are many times when questions are raised from a statement in Yerushalmi to the Bavli. Tosfos does it very often, less so in the Bavli itself, but nonetheless, it's a tremendous resource. There is a Daf Yomi in Talmud Yerushalmi that started only in the last decade, as far as I know, but it's not as popular as the Yerushalmi on the Daf Yomi on the Bavli. Now, one of the most momentous acts of the Sanhedrin took place around this time as well, and that was the institution of the Jewish calendar. Traditionally, our calendar was set al pi re'iya, re'yas edim, based on a monthly basis through the testimony of 2 witnesses who came to the Sanhedrin and testified that the sliver of the new moon had been seen. The Gemara Rosh Hashanah has a very elaborate description of this process, how the witnesses were verified, what they saw, when they saw it, Where in the sky they saw it? What precise shape did they see? All to verify that they had actually seen it, and based on that, we knew when the Yom Tovim would fall. After the adjudication, the Sanhedrin would announce, Mikudosh, Mikudosh, the month is sanctified. In the olden days, the word would be sent to the Beis HaMikdash, they'd bring karbonos, they would start sending out the signals of torches to the distant lands. Now, it was not completely open-ended. It was somewhat limited, as a month could never be more than 30 days. So by the 30th day, they would just declare Rosh Chodesh then. And of course, the other complication was that the Sanhedrin would declare a leap year occasionally to ensure that Pesach would fall in the spring. In 359 of the Common Era, the Nasi Hillel II, 350 years or so after his ancestor, Hillel HaZaken, Hillel II realized the impending calamity, the weakening of the Sanhedrin, and the very imminent inability of the Sanhedrin to meet regularly to determine when Rosh Chodesh would be and disseminate that information across the globe. So he devised a permanent calendar that is still in use. So just briefly, we have a lunisolar calendar, meaning we follow the lunar month, but coordinate with the solar year as well. The lunar month, the Gemara says, is 29 days, 12 hours, and 793 chalokim. A chalek is 3 1/3 seconds. So that calculates out, follow this, the lunar month, is, according to the Gemara, is 29.530594 days. NASA calculates it at 29.530588 days, which is a difference of 0.000006, a difference of 6 millionths of a day. That was the calculation of Chazal then to what we calculate today. The average year has 354 days. This happens to be this year an average year. We have 354 days. Our months always alternate between months of 29 and 30 days based on the calendar, with variable months of Mar Cheshvan and Kislev. They could either be 29 days or 30 days or 29 and 30. So I say this is an average year, because this year, Rosh Chodesh is Friday, is one day, so Mar Cheshvan this year is a month of 29 days. Kislev happens to be a month of 30 days, the 2 days Rosh Chodesh next month at the end of Chanukah. So that's why our years could have either 353 days, 354 days, or 355 days. The calendar itself was placed on a 19-year cycle. I think we're in the 12th year of the cycle, with a leap month added according to a formula 7 times every 19 years in order to synchronize with the solar year. So it comes out over the course of 19 years. We have in our calendar about 6,930 days, and the secular calendar about 6,932 days. That's really very close. The tremendous Gaonim worked on it. The calendar was an act of genius, and it had far-reaching consequences. Firstly, no longer would Jews be in doubt as to when Yom Tov would fall. Everyone had a calendar. Nor would we be subject to those, so you could plan to go away for Pesach, you knew when to book the hotel. Nor would we be subject to the whims of rulers and the instability of life in Israel. The Gemara records already in Rabbi Akiva's time, he had to flee Israel several times to calculate Rosh Chodesh in Bavel, in Chutzal Ha'aretz, which was a violation, but they had no choice. Thirdly, Hillel II here imposed the great rule, infamous to some, ordaining the continuation of Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golios. So that already existed during the Second Beis HaMikdash era, especially when the Samaritans began to distort the communication through the torches. It would go from mountain to mountain with torches, and they would do it a day early or a day late just to throw the schedule off. So then they decided right then, if messengers who would now be sent in place of the torches could not reach certain locations within a week, then those locations would observe 2 days of Yom Tov. So Gemara says in Beit Daf Dalam and Beis, Tehoidna Yodiyam Bekviya Diyarcha Vikavdinon Treyome. Now, once the calendar was in existence, so we know how to ordain the months, we know when Yom Tov will fall,
So still we observe 2 days in the exile. So this is a clear indication. One of the great errors people make in life, they think we observe the second day in Golos because of Sveka the Yoma. That's not true. That's originally the case in the Gemara. But there's no Suffolk anymore today. Gemara says there's no Suffolk. There's no Suffolk. We observe 2 days in the exile. The Gemara there says, Mishum the Shochu Mitom. They send from there. Where's there? Here. They sent from Eretz Yisrael. Hill the second, the Nasi the Sanhedrin ruled, and they sent this to Bavel. He's Zaharu b'minag avasechem b'yedechem. Take heed of the customs of your forefathers. Zimnin de gazu shmada v'asli l'gal kulkule. The times there'll be a shmad as well, and you'll upset, you'll miscalculate, and you will not observe the Yom Tov, especially Chometz on Pesach, properly. So Rashi says, the Rambam says in Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, Perek HaLocha Hey, gives some of the history, he's Bizman HaZeh She'ein Sham Sanhedrin. In our day there's no Sanhedrin, who based in Shalaret Yisrael Kovin Al Cheshbon Zeh, and the court in Israel calculates based, or decides based on this calculation. Theoretically, that now that everybody knows, we're all on the same page, you have only one day Yom Tov. Afil hamekomos harachoka shebechutz laretz, kamo b'nei Eretz Yisrael, we could have held one day as well. Shakol cheshbon echad somchim mekomim, everybody now relies on the same calculation, Hillel's calculation. Avol takonas chachomim hi sheizor b'vinag avaseyim b'shevi yadeyah. The takon of the chachomim, for a variety of reasons, I spoke about it years ago, said that that's the minhag of our fathers in the exile, we still hold 2 days. Now, it's an important point. Based on the Rambam, there still must be a population of Jews in Eretz Yisrael at all times in order to ratify this calculation every month. It's based in Shel Eretz Yisrael, Kovin Al Cheshbon Zeh. They're the ones who do it. That's why we announce every month, like we did last Shabbos, whatever the mode will be, Jerusalem sundial time. It's based on the time in Yerushalayim. It's the Jews in Yerushalayim who are Koveya when Rosh Chodesh falls, and that word still goes out to the exile every month. So Rambam says, Umeimosai hischilu kol Yisrael l'chashev v'cheshbon zeh. When do we start calculating based on Hill's calendar? Misof chachmei Talmud ba'eish shehirba shechor v'Eretz Yisrael. From the end of the sages of the Talmud, when Eretz Yisrael was in destruction, v'lo nisha shom based in kavua, and there was no longer there. He meant there would shortly no longer be there a fixed based in. Alba b'mechachmei Mishnah, v'chem mechachmei Talmud, ad yimei abayiv arovo, al kliyas Eretz Yisrael ha'yusamchin. From the days of the Mishnah until these days, of abayiv arovo, it's a little after, Rava died in 352, they used the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin decided al pi re'iyah. And the Rambam says as follows, in the Sefer Mitzos, Mitzvah Kuf Nun Gimel, the Mitzvah L'chadesh Chadoshim, Ilu Ifshar Derech Moshal, if we would entertain the possibility, Shepinei Eretz Yisrael, Yadrum Eretz Yisrael, that the Jews of Israel would in toto disappear from the land of Israel, Cholila Lokel Me'asosos, God forbid such a thing could happen, Ki hu iftiach shelo yimcha oso sa'u mikol v'chol. God guaranteed that the signs of our people would never be completely eliminated. V'liyah shom beistin, v'liyah b'chus l'aretz beistin shenismach b'aretz. And there wouldn't be a beistin in Israel, or a beistin of smuchim, of ordained rabbonim outside of Eretz Yisrael, to decide when the new month begins. The calendar would not help us at all. We could not declare Rosh Chodesh. So the existence of the calendar and the continuity of the Jewish people depend on there always being a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. Now this puts the lie to the myth, even propagated by some Zionists, that the land of Israel was empty of Jews for 19 centuries. That's false. There were always Jews in Israel, and on that basis the calendar continued. To be able to have a calendar is indispensable. indispensable to Jewish life. We really mark the rhythms of our life through the calendar. One of the first things the communists banned in the Soviet Union in 1917 was the printing of the Jewish calendar, a ban that lasted 70 years. You see, one of the things they always used to smuggle into Soviet Jews were calendars, the year's calendars. Something else caused Hillel to promulgate this calendar through the Sanhedrin. After Constantine's death, a war raged for 20 years between his heirs, those three who bore his name, and some of their cousins, most of whom killed each other. The sole survivor was a nephew of Constantine named Julian, who became famous as Julian the Apostate. After gaining power from his uncle, Constantius II, in 360, Julian renounced Christianity, apparently having grown up and witnessed its ravages. That's why he's known as Julian the Apostate. He was the last non-Christian emperor of Rome. In 360, he decided, he decided to attack Shapur II in Bavel, and he reached out in sincerity to the Jews of Eretz Yisrael. Remember, Israel is a transit point. He reached out to the Jews there for assistance. There are two consequences. First, some say that Hillel used this respite wisely, because he would be the last Christian emperor, and Chazal saw the handwriting on the wall. They knew that they sensed that his empire would not last long, and they saw the decline. But now is a period of stability when Julian reigned for those few years. They took advantage of that time to meet in public and to work out this calendar. Julian did something else to gain the succor of the Jews, and that is he granted permission to the Jews to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. This was in a letter to Hillel II in 361. You recall from a few weeks back. Now this is the third and final time that serious plans were considered, at least, to build the Beis HaMikdash after the Churban. The first, and when Hadrian ruled, at the beginning of Hadrian's rule, the second time during the reign of Bar Kokhba, and now this is the third time. So Julian offered them the right to build the Beis HaMikdash. Some say even, you know, the fundraising started, probably always was fundraising for the Beis HaMikdash, even before Julian's time. But the fundraising started, they started making plans, but Hillel II and the rest of the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael played it coy, not believing it would come to fruition, and especially not wanting to antagonize Shapur II, who had been, after all, a friend to the Jews of Bavel, and had given the Babylonian Jews tremendous autonomy. So in fact, they did not accept Julian's plan. In any event, the plan died in 363, along with Julian, killed in his failed attempt to conquer Parthia. Now, Hillel had another motivation as well, and that was the Sanhedrin was coming to an end. The Jewish population in the land of Israel had fallen below replacement level, and with it the institution of smicha, the ordaining of rabbis that had begun with Moshe Rabbeinu, that was lapsing as well. Notice, we have smicha today also. There's a difference between the smicha today and the smicha that existed in the time of the Talmud for Moshe's time. Today it's essentially a heter horah. Permission is given to Rabbanim who've accumulated a certain amount of knowledge to teach and decide questions of law. That's not the smicha, so we euphemistically call it smicha. That's not the smicha that existed for Moshe Rabbeinu, which of course gave the Rabbanim the right to judge capital cases and cases of knossos, of fines. By law, smicha could be conferred only in Israel, and that required a yeshiva gedola that Israel could no longer sustain. And of course, only a basin of smuchim, of ordained rabbis, could declare Rosh Chodesh. And that was going to end as well. He was very prescient, Hillel II. So he did the next best thing and had a Sanhedrin of smuchim fix the calendar for all time, or at least until Bias Mashiach Sukenu. The Nesias itself would be disbanded in 429, although it was not at all influential after the reign of Hillel II. the decade earlier, in the early 350s, the last yeshiva in Israel, probably for 800 years, would be in Sipore under the leadership of Rabbi Hanina and Rav Mani. That would close in mid-century after a reign of terror at the hands of a Roman general, Ursus Sinus, who fabricated news of a rebellion of Jews in order to slaughter, literally slaughter, most of the Jews of Israel. So that development cut short the editing of the Talmud Yerushalmi, one of the reasons why it's more difficult to learn, and Hillel's work was essentially a response to these massacres. From then on, for several centuries, Israel was ruled by the Byzantine Empire, so-called because Constantine had relocated his capital to Byzantium, and of course renamed it in his honor. In 378, the Julian's reign was very short-lived. Theodosius became the emperor. He was the last Roman emperor to rule over both east and west. His son, Theodosius II, both of them back to being Christians, succeeded him in 395 in the Eastern Empire. That Eastern Empire included the land of Israel. At this point, there were communities in Alexandria and Antioch throughout Europe, but the main locus of Jews was in Babel, and would soon feature in the 5th century another legendary figure, Rav Ashi, who would assemble the greatest compilation of Jewish knowledge, the Talmud, which is the lifeblood of Jewish scholarship, if not of the Jewish people itself. Just to summarize briefly, in the 4th century, Christianity found itself, began clarifying its doctrines, adopting its own calendar, and further distancing itself from its Jewish roots. Part of that distancing meant the beginning of the relentless persecution of Jews for our audacity in rejecting the Christianity that they felt we had, so to speak, spawned. The Roman Empire itself became Christian, and one of its constituent parts, the Byzantines, became rulers of Israel, except for Julian the Apostate in the last gasp attempt to build a Beis HaMikdash. The Jews of Israel spent almost the entire century hounded, harassed, and massacred. So Israel declined even more until by century's end it was barely a factor in Jewish life. But in its waning moments, the Talmid HaChachamim of Eretz Yisrael promulgated the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Sanhedrin fixed a permanent calendar that has sustained us until today, each month like clockwork. This endeavor presaged the end of Smicha, the end of the Sanhedrin, and soon the end of the Nisius. Meanwhile, the Jews of Bavel basked in relatively glorious times, prosperity, tranquility, and Torah. Rabbi and Rav Yosef, Abaye and Rava, Rav Nachman and Rav Papa, together they're mentioned in the Talmud maybe 6,000-7,000 times. And that would be the main focus of Rav Ashi and Ravina and the Jews of the 5th century. I thank you all very much.